welcome to KUNM's Year in Review. Today we'll be looking back with local journalists at the year in New Mexico news, the big ongoing stories that will definitely continue to affect us as we move into 2017. There were so many big stories in New Mexico this year that it was hard to pare down a list. Instead, we're going to be talking about four themes: child abuse and well-being, law enforcement, politics, and SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. These can be kind of heavy topics, and we've got a post up with links to resources as well as reporting from all of the journalists we're talking to today. Find it online at KUNM.org. Joining me in the studio, we have longtime criminal justice reporter Jeff Proctor, Sarah Gustavez, a producer of New Mexico in Focus at PBS, Elise Kaplan, who is part of the breaking news crime coverage team at the Albuquerque Journal, and Joey Peters of the online news outlet nmpoliticalreport.com. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Good morning.
One of the toughest recurring stories this year was about children being killed. Victoria Martins, Ashlyn Mike, the family shooting in Roswell, the murder of Kam Tito and Ni Nguyen, and three kids in Albuquerque who were just killed. Elise Kaplan has covered many of these deaths for the Albuquerque Journal. Elise, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Marisa.
So you work as part of a crime and breaking news team, and that means sometimes covering this kind of thing is part of your job. Why do you think it's important to get these stories out there?
Yeah, I do this with Nicole Perez and our editor, Robert Brauman, and we cover all of the hardest stories as a team together. And I think it's really important to get it out there because it's kind of the first chapter to see what's going to change and what's going to kind of come next. Reporting on these stories is really, really difficult, but it also gives these little kids a human voice and a face and makes people care about them in a way that I feel like is really important. With that, like, people can start to move towards what can come next and how can we help them in the future.
We saw such a big reaction to the death of Victoria Martins. Why do you think some of these stories really stir people?
I think the Victoria case really stirred people because of the role of her mother in the case. I think we see time and time again that mothers are blamed for things in ways that fathers sometimes aren't quite as much. And this case was so horrific and it was so terrible and the details were so just horrifying. I think people are really kind of gravitated towards figuring out what happened and figuring out why, how this could have happened and what is going to come next. And I think that one really made a huge impact just because of the role of drugs as well and the fact that there was three suspects. I think getting her picture out there right away really helped. I talked to a family friend the day after the killing, and she gave me a photo of Victoria, and you could see this beautiful little girl with her big smile. I think that really impacted people, too, to see that face and see that she's like a real little girl that's just like all the other little girls.
There was also a lot of heartache after Ashlyn Mike was killed as well. Do you think that story really kind of played into parents' worst fears?
Yes, absolutely. I went out to Shiprock right after that happened to report out there while Nicole and Rob stayed in Albuquerque. And every single person I talked to said, oh, my God, this could be my kid. They all talked about talking to their kids about how to, you know, protect themselves from stranger danger, about not getting in the car with anyone else, about just being safe. The school went on like lockdown after school to make sure that all parents were picking up their kids at school instead of letting them take the bus. I think it's definitely everybody's worst fear, and there's no way except talking to your kids to feel like you can really guard against that.
And in other instances, like for Kam Tito and Ni Nguyen, which happened right after Victoria Martins was also in Albuquerque, there wasn't the same outcry. Why is that?
I think part of that is because it's a murder-suicide, and because it's all contained in one family, it feels a little bit less scary than the thing with Ashlyn Mike, where it's, you know, it's a stranger. Also, with murder-suicides, we often don't have the same court documents because the suspect is dead. So there's less of a narrative out there for us to report on. We're kind of more dependent on what people will say, the people who will talk to us, and often people don't want to talk because it's all within the family, so it's difficult to talk about. There's also not the same, you know, we have to rely on what police say about it and not so much about the criminal complaint or the court documents or their attorneys and stuff, so it's harder to get the story out there. I also think people are tired. We just come off of Victoria, and everybody was horrified by that. It just kind of overshadowed, I think, Ni Nguyen a little bit in Kamto.
I often wondered if race was a factor. Do you think that it was?
I don't in this case. I think we've seen kind of similar reactions with other murder suicides. As tragic as they are, they do get less interest. People kind of understand that narrative of the mother's husband or boyfriend killing or abusing the children. It's kind of something you can wrap your mind around, as unfortunate as that is, whereas the other cases are more sensational. So I don't think that race really played into this one.
So in the past, you also did a story about ineffective restraining orders, and you just did a piece about some of the bigger systemic failures when it comes to domestic violence. How do those stories tie into these deaths?
Stalking is definitely, experts all over the field say that it's a kind of a indicator of violence later on. It's about control. It's about kind of like obsession. And in this most recent case with the three kids who were killed in Fort Hills, the suspect had a history of stalking and a history of abusing ex-girlfriends and just kind of showing that's kind of a systemic problem where it keeps on happening and it's not happening just out of the blue.
So this morning we're going to do something a little different. This show is a rare pre-recorded show, so we won't be taking any calls. This year's been kind of a tough one news-wise, so we'd still love to hear from you, especially if you've got any good news to share, good or bad. Tweet at us right now. We're at KUNM News. Use the hashtag YearNNM. Now, Elise, this is the story this year and in many other years. Do you think there can be kind of a growing despair about these situations in New Mexico?
Yes, in some cases. I think that we're used to seeing it and that it's tragic and it's terrible. So I do think people are kind of despairing and tired of seeing it again and again. You know, we stand up and say another child has been killed and it's horrifying and terrible and tragic. So I do think that there is some despair. But what I really like is after each one of these horrible cases, there's a vigil and people really come out from the community to like pray and to light candles and feel sad and release balloons, and there's memorials that are put up. So that makes me think that people aren't entirely despairing. It is kind of this outpouring of love after each one. Even people who don't know her, like thousands of people went to Victoria's heavenly birthday the weekend after that happened. And those weren't her friends. Those are people from the community who are affected. So I have to believe that's not all despair.
Sarah Gustavez, you and I teamed up this year and did some reporting on child abuse prevention programs that teams up nurses and families. And what really stood out for you?
Well, I think with what Elise was just talking about we do see these very sad, very high profile cases so often. And although there are the vigils, I cover the legislature a lot, and then I don't see those people at the legislature advocating for policy change. CYFD is chronically underfunded in some areas. I don't really see people in the community coming out. And there are challenges to that. I don't want to say it's their fault. Like, it's hard to get up to Santa Fe. It's hard to get up to Santa Fe during the session, during the week. But there's kind of a disconnect of, like, there needs to be a larger conversation about policy. And I think that was where we had a great opportunity to take a step back and say, what is working? And that's kind of our goal with New Mexico in Focus. Since we're a weekly show, we keep track of all these things that are going on in the news. And then we look at the bigger picture. We look at policy. We look at priorities for the state, for communities, for leaders. And I think we went and covered the Nurse Family Partnership. We visited with the family. And I think it's so important to talk to families that are using these programs and programs that are positive, that say not you're doing something wrong, we're going to come in and tell you to do what's right, but say families have a lot of challenges today in New Mexico and everywhere in the country. Lots of things they're dealing with. And there's opportunities to have professionals come in and say, what do you need? Do you need some education on child development? Do you need some help with transportation? Do you need some help with housing? And help those families get the services that they need, the things that cause stress that lead to child abuse later. And one thing that really stuck out to me when you and I were doing that reporting is there are these high-profile cases that have gotten a lot of coverage, but when we looked at the numbers in New Mexico of children who are abused and neglected, not have been killed, but are enormous. But these, you know, and may say, oh, well, you know, neglect can be so many different things, but it can have such a lasting impact on children, can impact how well they do in school, can impact how they see the world as they're growing up, how they feel about themselves. And I think that's important, and we need to take those opportunities to look at that bigger picture of children that maybe aren't at risk of dying but are still being neglected and abused.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that really struck me was that there is this Nurse Family Partnership Program, and it is, you know, shown around the country. They've done studies that it really does effectively reduce child abuse. And some of the people we talked to really mentioned that we don't have to accept child abuse as just a reality. Like, this is a totally solvable, fightable problem. But the program is reaching only a small portion of the people in New Mexico that it could really help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not all home visiting is the same. There are lots of home visiting programs in New Mexico. Some of them are community members, and there's some value in that too. But the nurses, these, you know, highly trained professionals with a lot of skills and a lot that they bring to the table, they're more expensive. So that program also is a smaller mm-hmm. program because it costs more.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeff, you actually did some reporting on this a couple years ago. How does the Children, Youth, and Families Department see its role in prevention?
I don't think that we have a great sense of what the mandated priority is for CYFD at this point, where prevention is concerned. I did do a story on this when I was still at KRQE with Katie Kim, and we interviewed the cabinet secretary, the previous cabinet secretary, who told us on a number of occasions during that interview that the administration did not believe that child abuse and neglect prevention was the state's job. We were pretty shocked by that. We felt like that was a shocking story to put on the air. I'm not sure at this point how the administration's priorities have changed. We do have a new cabinet secretary at this point, but I know that would have required a really fundamental shift at the top of the Children, Youth, and Families Department. Obviously, there are a huge number of people who work in the field for that department who are doing their best every day, but it's difficult to affect kind of a large-scale and broad prevention effort when the department doesn't believe that that's what it's supposed to be in the business of. So it's really a question of whether that department is in a reactive mode, reacting to these awful kinds of stories that that Elise is reporting on, or if they're really looking at trying to solve the systemic issues and work as an affirmative, positive force in people's lives.
One thing from this year is that they ran an ad campaign of encouraging people to report child abuse and neglect, which we talked to some people from New Mexico in Focus, and it was kind of two sides to that. On the one hand, it's good to give people some power and say, if you're concerned about a child, you should speak up, you should say something, you know, maybe report that. But also people saying that's not enough. An ad campaign is not enough to address what we're facing in New Mexico.
And they spent a lot of money on that ad campaign, mm-hmm. millions of dollars.
Millions.
Mm-hmm. And so when we see these big reactions to these situations, to these instances of child abuse or child abuse resulting in death, there seems to always be a call for tougher laws and harsher penalties. Sarah, talk about how we're seeing that play out this year.
Well, that played out in the special session. The governor, you know, had some lawmakers, you know, she pushed reintroducing the death penalty for cases involving the murder of children and police officers, but they really used the Victoria Martins case as an example. This is kind of how it is. They use cases like that. The families come up to the legislature. It's incredibly, you know, it's an incredibly sad story. It didn't go anywhere, and a lot of us who follow the legislature really closely didn't expect it to go anywhere in the special session, but it will probably come up again.
Okay, we're taking a look back at some of the big themes of news in New Mexico from 2016. This is KUNM's Year in Review show, and I'm your host, Marisa DeMarco. We're not live, so we're not taking calls today, but we still want to hear from you. What was the big news for you this year? What captured your attention? What do you think got missed? Shoot us a tweet at KUNM News with the hashtag YearInNM.
Conductor Simon Rattle.
I've known the Nutcracker since I was a kid, but it came relatively late on that I started listening to the whole piece. I became more and more fascinated by this music.
Coming up, Simon Rattle conducting the Berlin Philharmonic in the Nutcracker on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to KUNM's Year in Review. I'm Marisa DeMarco, and today we're talking with other journalists from New Mexico. We've got longtime criminal justice reporter Jeff Proctor, Elise Kaplan from the Albuquerque Journal, NM Political Report's Joey Peters, and Sarah Gustavez of New Mexico PBS. Now we're going to get into police and criminal justice by looking back at the murder trial for two police officers who shot and killed James Boyd in Albuquerque. Jeff Proctor, you've been covering the the story of police shootings here for years. When you think back to the early days of your reporting on this stuff, did you ever think that eventually two Albuquerque Police Department officers would be on trial for murder?
No, in a word. We didn't really have a mechanism to get all the way to the point of a public trial for this. The system that was in place in Albuquerque was very much designed to clear officers regardless of what those circumstances of the shooting were. Furthermore, the advent of the camera, I really think, made a tremendous change in the way people perceived these things. So, no, I definitely didn't think that we would ever see something like that happen here.
And so many people saw the James Boyd shooting video back when it was first released to the public and felt like it was just so plain that here was this homeless guy and he was surrendering and then he got killed. How do you think the defense worked around that during the trial?
I think the defense leaned on the way you would go about defending two police officers for an on-duty shooting, to kind of fall back on what Supreme Court case law says and what training says. Basically, their theory of what the case was, we cannot, as a country, as a city, as a state, train police officers to go out and deal with a situation in a given way, have them do that, and then turn around and prosecute them for it. That's really what the defense sort of boiled down to at the end of the day. I mean, that was the closing argument that their lawyers made in court, and frankly, that seemed like the right way to try to defend them, given what the system currently is.
What was some of the testimony that really stood out to you during the trial? Were there some questions that you had that were answered on the stand?
No, but I'm probably an off-the-beaten-track case here. I had followed that case so incredibly closely and written literally tens of thousands of words about that particular shooting and the way it fit in context. So there weren't really any revelations at trial in terms of what happened in the events surrounding the shooting or at the shooting itself. I did find it striking to hear from the two officers themselves. That's a really rare look, to be able to hear we're having this huge national discussion about police shootings, to be able to hear from two shooting officers what they perceived in the moment, what they felt like their role was, how they perceived Mr. Boyd. I felt like that was revelatory. But in terms of details about the case, I think we knew most of it, those who'd followed it closely before the trial.
And I thought, being there, that it was interesting that, you know, I mean, so many times I've reached out to APD for comment. And I remember when a lot of these police shootings were happening that I really just wanted to speak to, you know, a beat cop, to an officer, about, you know, what's their job and what's it like, and what's it like to be in those situations and making those decisions. And, you know, I mean, always APD refused my requests for interviews, and that's been pretty consistent for me for many years. So for me, it was kind of the first time of really hearing people talk about that stuff, you know, and talking about what it's like to be in those situations.
Yeah, it's a pretty closed society over there. Obviously, I've had my own struggles in terms of getting them to respond and answer questions and those kinds of things. I've covered the police for a long time here and have had discussions with officers who've shot people in the past and officers who've been present when people were shot. But yes, to sort of hear it with all of the noise around it turned off in terms of sworn testimony in court, I thought that was an amazing thing to witness.
And so much of Keith Sandy's testimony was about, you know, some things that he said before he even got to the scene, and about, you know, it seemed like there was questions about respect for human life that, you know, accompanies this job, right?
Yes. Obviously, Keith Sandy had an awful lot more to explain in terms of his role in that shooting than the other officer, Dominic Perez, had. I don't know that I heard a tremendous amount from him on the stand in terms of really explaining some of those things. It seemed like the theory or the strategy of the defense was to get more quickly to, this guy had knives, I had no other choice, really. Obviously, he was forced to answer some questions about the things he said in advance, namely that he planned to use force against someone he hadn't even seen yet. So it was interesting to hear the way he tried to explain that. I didn't feel like there was – it felt unsatisfying, to be honest with you, in terms of how much he described that.
And then also hearing from the neighbor in that case, you know, really brought up a lot of questions for me about how we view homeless people and folks with mental illness in our community, because we heard Alexander Thixton really upset because there was somebody living, you know, not too terribly far from his house, he thought. So I thought that that kind of brought in some of the broader issues about what do we expect people to do in Albuquerque and where do we expect people to be?
And what is the role of the police? I mean, I know that felt to a lot of people who watched that part of the trial like basically the police are acting in this case as a taxpayer funded service to go out and do the bidding of rich people. So I know that there was a pretty visceral reaction to what, if you really boiled that down, this was a well-to-do person living up in the foothills who called the police and basically asked them to deal with what he perceived as a problem. So I think that is a conversation that I certainly hope continues. What are we asking the police to do? What problems are we asking them to solve that we're not willing to spend money on to solve in other ways that don't involve guns?
And I went and spoke with homeless advocates, I think the day the jury was deliberating, actually. And a lot of what we talked about was how homeless folks live their life in public because there just simply aren't enough shelter beds and other places for them to be. And that means there are a lot more interactions with police than there are for other people.
Yeah, that's a common theme and narrative that I've heard and something that I've reported on as well. There are certainly concerns that the ongoing Justice Department mandated reforms actually increase the number of interactions between officers and homeless people and people who are living with mental illness. I know that's been a concern of a lot of the advocacy groups in town that, you know, look, you're sending the police to deal with something where we're not even sure if a crime has been committed. Mm-hmm. So that's that larger conversation about so many of these societal problems we are asking the police to go and solve. And then we stand back and scratch our heads when we have these bad outcomes and people end up dead. But, you know, if you are a hammer, every problem tends to look like a nail.
Mm-hmm. And now we're hearing all of this stuff about APD officers potentially erasing or altering footage from some of these situations, both from body cams and maybe also from surveillance cameras. How does that impact this case or even just the tension between police and Albuquerque residents?
It's unclear yet how those allegations may or may not impact the Boyd case. There is some kind of tangential reference and allegation that there may have been some tampering with video from the James Boyd shooting. There's no direct allegation of that yet. Certainly it was enough to get the attention of the special prosecutor who is now looking into whether there was video from that case that that was deleted or changed in some way. And in terms of what it does for the police community relations here, obviously that's been a situation and a relationship that in a lot of corners of this city has been pretty frayed for a long time. I think also the body cameras themselves were sold to the public as this great tool of transparency and accountability. Mm-hmm. That's really what we were told those were supposed to be for. Here is an impartial view of the police-citizen encounter. The more we learn about the capabilities they have to change those videos and make them look the way they want them to look, I think that raises a lot of questions about the role and the efficacy of the body camera. I think people had hoped that that was going to be an accurate representation that we were never able to see before. We wouldn't have to just rely on the police report or the criminal complaint. We would actually be able to see it from another perspective. But if they have the ability, which my reporting has certainly shown that they do, to change those videos or slice them up in any way that they want us to see them, I think that's the bigger question. And again, I think it really kind of yanks off the scab for a lot of people who were distrustful of this police department anyway.
Now, Elise, it's not just the Albuquerque Police Department that is involved in shootings in New Mexico, right? There's other law enforcement agencies. And when officers from those agencies shoot someone, is there necessarily any recording or footage?
No, in lots of cases there aren't. There were 6 fatal shootings by law enforcement this year, and only one of them only involved APD. All of the rest involved the marshals or APD and BCSO or BCSO. So that means that there is often no recordings whatsoever of those. The marshals don't have lapels. They, in one case, went into a trailer park in the middle of the night looking for a homicide suspect and arguably maybe shot the wrong guy. We don't really know what happened in that case, but it was certainly would have been nice to have a video of it.
And when we're thinking about police shootings all over the state, Jeff, there's procedures that kind of vary. Is it inconsistent for investigating these police shootings?
Yes. In terms of reviewing an on-duty police shooting in New Mexico to determine whether or not it was within the law, we have a deeply flawed and frankly broken system that really kind of at the detail level looks like this patchwork of policies. And that starts with the investigation itself. Many police departments, including the New Mexico State Police and the Albuquerque Police, they investigate themselves. They investigate their own shootings. Some of the smaller agencies around the state rely on state police to investigate their shootings. So there is no consistency in terms of the way the actual evidence is handled, in terms of what the protocols are. And then when you get to the next level of the system, the reviews of those, once that investigation is done, it's handed over to a district attorney. That's done differently in nearly every jurisdiction in the state as well. And we've had really egregious examples of grand jury abuse in the past in Santa Fe County and also in Bernalillo County. Some of the district attorneys immediately hand those cases off. Some of them review them themselves. Some of them had even said on the record, we were doing a story for the Santa Fe New Mexican a couple of weekends ago, that they feel like their role in reviewing a police shooting investigation is to clear the officer's name. And then when you get beyond that, a lot of the experts we spoke to believe that the statutes themselves probably aren't even the right statutes. Is second-degree murder or voluntary manslaughter the right lens to look at an on-duty police shooting through to determine whether it has veered from negligent or out of policy into criminal? So we have a situation here where there's just not a good mechanism to make those determinations.
All right, we're going to shift gears here a little bit. I know that there's no way we can talk about the year and not talk about election season and politics, both local and national. And we're going to get there before we close this hour. But before we do, I want to talk about the SNAP story. And SNAP is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So often when we hear about applications being falsified for government benefits, we think of people lying on their own applications. But this year, the story was that the workers who collect and process applications testified in court that they were doctoring the numbers so it looked like people applying for emergency food stamps had more money than they really did. Now, Joe, you were at that very first hearing when no one had really ever heard about this practice at the Human Services Department yet. Tell us what it was like when that stuff came out in court.
Yeah, so that the first hearing, about 5 employees testified with these allegations, and that came very late in the day, about 5 o'clock after a long day in court. And I'm not sure, you know, HSD has always claimed that they never knew the extent of these allegations before they were made verbally in court. But about, you know, 4 hours before, I think what was telling to me was, you know, there was an official from HSD testifying, and she kind of ran through everybody that was about to testify and attempted to discredit their claims. But when those employees testified, it was, I think, there was a silence in the court, a kind of a shock in the court. Mm-hmm. And this is after a long day, or this is, yeah, at the end of a long day. And you know, no lawyer from HSD that I recall stood up and objected to anything they were saying. And after the hearing, just kind of quickly ran out and didn't comment to the press about what had just been alleged.
And there was a supervisor who gave some emotional testimony that day, right?
Yeah. So one of the five employees in the first hearing was a line manager. And she, because she's a manager, was not protected by the union like the other employees are. So there was a lot of chatter that day about how she was most vulnerable. Her job was most vulnerable when she was making her testimony. And yeah, I remember, one of the attorneys asking her, did you falsify documents? And there was a long pause.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said yes. And that it came from orders from our bosses.
Mm-hmm. So the workers drop this bombshell and everyone goes home for the day. And then at the next hearing, HSD comes back and the department's got a different lawyer. So what happens now?
Yeah, now they have Paul Kennedy, who's frequently represents the Martinez administration in these high-profile matters. And then you had four additional employees testifying. So I think we have a total of nine employees testifying with similar allegations. And I think, it needs to be emphasized that they're doing this under oath at a court, and that, when I talk to people who follow this issue nationally, they hear rumors like this all the time, that there's fraud going on in, mm-hmm. in food stamp programs, but you never see it alleged in court, in a court record. So we have more employees testifying, and then we have three HSD officials going up to the stand and taking the fifth, pleading their Fifth Amendment rights and refusing to answer questions.
Like 100 times, right? They said...
Yeah, there was a total of 100 questions between the three of them, and each time they refused to answer. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so then HSD was supposed to have this investigation done, this internal investigation done, but it never got finished. The investigator said later on that in court that it looked like this practice had been going on for years and years, that it even had a case as recently as just a week before that court hearing. But what's the fallout? What price does HSD have to pay ultimately?
I mean, so of those three officials who pled the fifth, I think one doesn't work for them anymore. That wasn't related to this. The other one was in charge of ISD, the Income Support Division, which basically runs all of SNAP. And she is not in charge of ISD anymore, and now she is her name is Marilyn Martinez. She's the chief of the department's Financial Services Bureau. And later on, the secretary, Brent Ernest, testified that, yes, we moved her, but it wasn't actually related to these allegations. We just thought she wasn't right for this job, basically. So really, there hasn't been that much fallout. Brent Ernest, who's the secretary, was held in contempt of court, but he's still secretary. And I think it needs to be mentioned that this all came from a lawsuit that's been going on,
mm-hmm.
first filed 25 years ago, that resulted in a consent decree in 1990. But basically, the lawsuit alleged that the state was not properly processing federal benefits like SNAP. And in 1990, there was a consent decree, which basically the court telling HSD, here's what you got to do. And so now the Center on Law and Poverty is saying they're not following that consent decree. And that's what Brent Ernest was held in contempt of court for.
And when we think about the impacts, it really means that people who need food assistance and need it right now didn't always get it. And Sarah and I talked to a person who experienced that. And the person, she was, she had a job and she was just, she was in a place where she had to make decisions about paying rent or buying food and groceries. And she applied for food assistance and would have been eligible for emergency food assistance within a week had her application not been changed by a worker. And then she never heard back from SNAP. She never heard back from HSD and just didn't know what happened to her application. And so one of the things that this this lawsuit also spoke to is the idea that people don't get information about whether their application has been denied or why or where it is in the process. And this is sometimes at like a very desperate time for them, right?
Yeah. And there's also the explanation as to why were they doing this in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And the explanation has been that it's because they have a huge, HSD has a huge backlog of these emergency SNAP applications that they haven't been able to process. Either they don't have the manpower or wherewithal to process all of these in the time period that federal law says you're supposed to process them, and that's 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, you have all these late applications that the state could be penalized for. The allegation goes that instead we've just been adding fake assets to their application, and then they don't, you know, either they don't get it or they benefits get delayed.
Yeah. This is KUNM's Year in Review, and I'm Marisa DeMarco. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
You have until December 31st to donate your car or truck and get a tax receipt for 2016. We'll arrange to pick it up, and even if it doesn't sell until January, you'll get a tax write-off for this year because you claim the deduction in the year it was donated. Hurry! To get a tax deduction for this year, you need to call before December 31st to see if your car qualifies. The number to call is 888-KUNM-CAR. Call today. That's 888-586-6227.
I'm Tara Gatewood, host of Native America Calling. Coming up on our next show, we'll discuss proposed pipelines. From Canada to New Mexico to Louisiana, there are dozens of pipeline projects in various stages of development. We'll hear more on some of these fights and the threats they pose to Native nations and surrounding areas.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to KUNM. I'm Marisa DeMarco, and today we're talking about the big news themes of 2016. I've been speaking with fellow journalists this hour, criminal justice reporter Jeff Proctor, Elise Kaplan from the Albuquerque Journal, NM Political Reports' Joey Peters, and Sarah Gustavez of New Mexico PBS. You can't look back at the year and not consider the election and the campaign season. Sarah, you were at both of President-elect Donald Trump's rallies in New Mexico. What stands out in your memory about them?
Yeah, for the first rally in May, the one that got a lot of the national attention for there being some violence afterwards, I was outside. And then the second one, I was inside the rally. But at both of them, I think what I was thinking a lot about as I was hearing about people protesting and hearing what they were talking about was the context of New Mexico. We're such an interesting state. We're a different state. One of the things, I moved here in 2008, and I've always been very interested in how we talk about ourselves in New Mexico and talk about how New Mexico thinks about issues like immigration. That's a big one. I've always heard New Mexicans describe the state and describe themselves as being a very tolerant state, a state that's tolerant of immigrants. I feel like in some ways that's changing. It's not the same conversation as Arizona or Texas, where I grew up, but we think of ourselves as being very tolerant. And in the October rally, when Trump came, he made a very quick stop at the airport, and I was inside. I was so surprised that one of the biggest cheers of the whole night, he kind of went through his stump speech, all the things that I'd seen on TV and I'd been hearing about for weeks. But I was surprised to be in there when he talked about keeping out Syrian refugees. And there was this huge cheer from the crowd. I mean, one of the biggest cheers of the whole night. And I thought that just seems to me unusual about New Mexico, because we think of ourselves like, hey, come on in. If you're good to other people, we're good here. And that was just really different. And I think that's a bit of the national conversation right now. But we have so few refugees in New Mexico. And I mean, a handful, if that, of Syrian refugees here. It just doesn't seem like it would be an issue that would resonate with people. So that kind of surprised me. I think also people connecting into this, on both sides of both people who support some of Trump's statements that he made about immigrants, and then people in New Mexico who really fought back against that. That was the message from a lot of the protesters in May, where they were saying, we're not like this. New Mexico doesn't agree with this. New Mexico's a tolerant place. We don't want this here. We don't want this this talk about immigrants in our state. So those were some of the big themes from the Trump rallies that stuck with me.
Yeah, and there's a lot of concern. So what I've been reading a lot about how a big part of Trump's election is this desire to keep outsiders out of the United States. And that's been, you know, something that really resonated with a lot of the voters. There's also a lot of concern about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. How do you think that's affecting people in New Mexico and how that's going to play out under a new administration?
Yeah, we have an interview with some DACA students on New Mexico in Focus this month. And I think a lot of people in the immigrant community are afraid. There's about 7,000 young people who applied for DACA protection up until June of this year, and almost double that were eligible in New Mexico. I mean, we're a small state. We don't have the same big numbers as California or Texas or other places, but that's a lot of people for New Mexico. And it's completely unclear. DACA is an executive order from President Obama. Trump could make that go away immediately. Trump could keep that for a while. The young folks that I talked to just had their DACA protection renewed through 2018. So if Trump does nothing, they're okay until 2018, but it's completely unknown what's going to happen next. If Congress is going to revisit the idea of immigration reform, which could include addressing the issue, DACA was created to address this very specific issue of young people who were brought here as children, mm-hmm. who grew up in the United States their entire lives. Some don't even, you know, if they came from Mexico, don't speak Spanish, to give them some sort of opportunity to finish school, to go to college, to get a job, a path to citizenship for them since they were children when they were brought here.
Now, here at home in New Mexico, we saw Maggie Toulouse-Oliver win the Secretary of State's office. She's run for that post before, and it's a government agency that's been plagued by corruption and mismanagement. What's the significance of Maggie Toulouse-Oliver's victory this year?
Well, the fact that we had an election for Secretary of State this year, we weren't supposed to. Diana Duran had to resign last year, and she had to step down after pleading guilty to felony convictions related to the misuse of campaign funds. So Maggie Toulouse-Oliver ran again, and Nora Espinoza was her Republican opponent. I think it's, you know, anyone in that position, it's significant because not only does the Secretary of State run elections, and people, as we've been talking about for weeks at the national level, want to trust the election process, want to trust that everything's being done correctly and transparently and being documented, but also the Secretary of State, a lot of people may not know, handles campaign finance reports. Their office takes those reports from elected officials and is supposed to keep track of them and make sure that everyone's doing the right thing and reporting all their money. We have, you know, Phil Griego, former lawmaker, is going to court for the misuse of funds and misreporting money on his campaign finance reports. So I think that's really important, that office going ahead of holding lawmakers accountable, holding elected officials and candidates accountable for accurately reporting the money that they bring in and how they spend it.
Mm-hmm. We also saw some changes in the legislature this year. We had a shift in the House of Representatives, which has a Democratic majority again. What are the changes that you took note of?
Well, I think Senator Sanchez lost his reelection bid in the Senate. He was an important leader in the Senate for a long, long time. He disagreed with Governor Martinez on a lot of issues. They, you know, have very different views on what they thought the priorities should be. He kept out some legislation that she supported, that she wanted, that passed the House when the Republicans were in charge. And then he kept it from going anywhere in the Senate. He was a very powerful leader. He was targeted by campaign ads this year, by PACs this year. He was targeted in a big way in the last election, too, and won his last election, but did not win his reelection bid this year. So that's really important. And we have now Senator Wirth, a Democrat from Santa Fe, is going to be the Senate Majority Leader. Also, Representative Brian Eagleoff is going to be the leader in the House side, also a Democrat from Santa Fe. I think they've been in the legislature a long time. It's significant that they're now in those leadership roles. But I think Sanchez being gone is a different. Yeah, a mm-hmm. lot of Democrats are talking about what he did. I think, you know, a lot of folks who disagreed with him, you know, are excited that there's going to be someone new in his seat. But I think that's, we're going to be watching what happens next.
And as we close out the year, we also saw Demesia Padilla, our tax and rev secretary, resign after the AG got a search warrant to raid her office. Joey, you covered that. What's all that about?
I mean, we're still kind of finding out, but I think what's really interesting is the search warrant talks about 127,000 that she got in income not related to her job with the state. And so where did that come from? And there's in the search warrant, one of them says it came from some of it came from a payday lending company. There was other, you know, she used to be an accountant before she was a secretary. And there was talk of, you know, whether some of those clients she used to have, she was still taking payments from as secretary. So I think, yeah, that's definitely a developing story.
Sarah, do you think that further damages the trust that people have with local politicians?
Yeah, I think people in New Mexico really want to be able to trust these elected officials, that they're doing the right thing, that they're handling. You know, we've got this ongoing budget deficit. There's not a lot of money to throw around in New Mexico. And I think people want to know that they can trust the folks in Santa Fe to be doing the right thing, to be effectively managing money, to be ethical in their decisions and how they're running their offices or departments. So I think that's going to be disappointing for a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm. We're nearing the end of the program today. Elise, have you been thinking about what might be different on the crime beat next year as the political winds shift?
Yeah, I don't really know yet, but I think there are going to be certainly some changes, maybe in the way we get records, in legislative stuff with the death penalty or stuff like that coming up again. I know there's a big push for it after some of the recent crimes. I don't really know where it's going yet, though.
And Jeff, thinking about the election, the APD reform effort, you know, it isn't going so well, according to the Monitor, James Ginger. And everything might shift under President-elect Trump and a new federal Department of Justice. What do you make of all that?
Certainly, I think we're going to see a totally different priority coming from Main Justice and from the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. This is a campaign that was waged, at least in this particular area, on ending the so-called war on cops. Lots of sort of overt criticism of the Obama administration's efforts to reform police departments. Ultimately, this is being overseen by a judge, the effort to change APD between the police department and the Justice Department. I don't know. I think we could potentially see a motion from DOJ to dismiss that entire action. That'll be up to the judge whether or not to grant that motion. But you might have to let somebody else stand on the other side if the Justice Department is not willing. There have clearly been some priorities from the Civil Rights Division in particular. You also look at what happened at the University of New Mexico. There was that investigation and some findings and a reform effort that's taking place there to change the way the university responds to allegations of sexual assault and sexual harassment. I think it's unclear exactly how that's going to change at the local level. But certainly if you pay attention and did pay attention to the campaign rhetoric, I think you're going to see a really different set of priorities coming from the Justice Department.
Joey, SNAP is federal money, and there's this ongoing investigation by the USDA into those workers talking about doctoring people's applications and the widespread practice of that. Is there a possibility that this could all change under the new administration and a new president?
I think we don't know is the answer, but this investigation has been going on since the summer, I think since August. So it's presumably they're already deep in the investigation. And the other thing that's happening is there's a federally court-appointed special master, quote-unquote, who will basically is an independent person who will oversee the entire benefits processing for the next year and report to the court on, you know, whether they're following federal law or not. So that man's name is Lawrence Parker. He's from Texas. I believe he's come here a few times and has met with HSD and that. So that process is getting started as well.
Sarah, we saw this year also this groundswell of support for people working to stop the pipeline in North Dakota. And now maybe also people are organizing to stop one here in New Mexico in Chaco Canyon. Do you have any predictions about how that's going to play out under a new administration?
Oh yeah, there's so many factors there to consider, but I think it is. I think the new administration is important when we're talking about the environment. President-elect Trump has already said he's going to nominate, you know, Rick Perry as the Energy Department Secretary. That's a very big deal. Rick Perry, former governor of Texas, who wanted to abolish the Energy Department. I think who Trump puts in charge of the EPA and various other environmental agencies in the federal level, I think is going to play a huge role in the conversation with local activists and advocates for environmental protections here in New Mexico. I do think Native leaders in New Mexico are going to play a role in the conversation about energy policy, about environmental issues in the future. I think we should expect to see more of that here. And then I think following the state and federal regulations is going to be really important moving ahead when we look at energy.
All right, we're coming to the end of the hour today. You can find more of our coverage on these stories and resources online at KUNM.org. Thanks for joining us for KUNM's Year in Review. Elise Kaplan, who reports breaking news for the Albuquerque Journal, longtime criminal justice reporter Jeff Proctor, Joey Peters, a reporter for NM Political Report, journalist Sarah Gustavez, a producer at New Mexico In Focus on PBS. Thanks, everyone, for being here. This is the last show of the year. The KUNM Call-In Show will be back on January 12th with a legislative preview with host Gwyneth Dolan for the People, Power, and Democracy Project. If you missed any of our program, or if you'd like to share it with friends, the audio of this show will be posted on our website, KUNM.org, where you can also find call-in shows from throughout 2016 and beyond. Thanks to Marino Spencer, our engineer today, and Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Marisa DeMarco, and this is KUNM.
We've got an update since this show was recorded. The Bureau of Land Management announced over the weekend that the oil company looking to build the Piñon pipeline near Chaco Canyon is withdrawing its application. Find out more online at KUNM.org.